right, welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Max Kaiser. We have a great show for you today. With us, we have Daniel Tillers, who is Assistant Professor of History at the Pedagogical University of Krakow in Poland. He's here to talk about his new book, British Fascist Antisemitism and Jewish Responses, 1932 to 1940. It was published in 2015 by Bloomsbury. Thanks very much for being on the show today, Daniel.
Thanks for inviting me.
First off, how did you come to write this book?
Well, the book stems from my PhD thesis, which I wrote at the University of London a few years ago under the supervision of David Cesarani. I'd had a kind of long-standing interest in fascism generally and British fascism in particular, going back really to my undergrad history days when I studied under Roger Griffin, who's a renowned scholar of fascism, and helped to spark my interest in the subject. And I think the first academic article I ever published was on British fascists or fascist-related violence, a conflict between the British fascists and anti-fascists, and especially Jews and the fascist anti-Semitism that caused that conflict. So when it came to doing the PhD, that was something that I'd already spent a lot of time and effort researching and writing on. And then the book itself, or the PhD, which led to the book, I suppose, motivated by the fact that I felt, and I think this came out in the book, that although all of the individual topics that I include in the book have been extremely well covered in the historiography, and some, as I mentioned in the book, some would say they've been too well covered, they've received more attention than they deserve. So British fascism, British Jewish history, the history of anti-Semitism in Britain, British anti-fascism, these have all received a lot of attention, but I felt that most of the existing work focused on these areas individually and in isolation, and there had been relatively little effort to bridge the gaps between them and to produce accounts of this period that made use of sources from all of these areas. So scholars of British fascism focused on fascist sources, scholars of Anglo-Jewish history focused on Jewish sources, and there was relatively little effort to bring these together and to produce an account that that combined them. And this was especially strange from my perspective, given that so many scholars in all the areas had focused on this issue of so-called interaction between them. So the extent to which and the way in which these different groups, fascists, Jews, anti-fascists, the state, interacted with one another, the relationship they had with one another. So it seemed to me that what was lacking was a single account that didn't just focus from one perspective, but brought all of the different sides together.
Great. So your book focuses on the period 1932 to 1940. Why did you choose this period, and what was sort of the more general historical and political context for the story that you outline here? What was happening in the world and in Britain at this time?
Yeah, well, of course, yeah, the dates that are chosen relate precisely to those, both the international and domestic context. Specifically, I mean, the dates 1932 to 1940 reflect the date of the founding and the dissolution of the main British fascist party during the interwar period, or the largest British fascist party that's ever existed at any stage, the British Union of Fascists, Oswald Mosley's party. And it was the BUF that was the main focus of my analysis, especially when it came to British fascist anti-Semitism. So in that regard, it made sense to for the chronological period of the book to start and finish with the foundation and dissolution of the BUF. But also, of course, this period, the 1930s generally, but the period that I've chosen in particular covers the most intense period of conflict in Britain between the fascists and their Jewish opponents. And of course, if you look at events in Europe, it was 1932 when Hitler rose to power, and 1939 when the war broke out, which makes a kind of a natural conclusion to the period that I'm looking at. Though I extend slightly into the war, because the fascists continued to function for the first few months of the war before they were dissolved by the British state. So in terms of both the domestic context and the international context, the time period 32 to 40 made sense.
So tell us a bit more about the British Union of Fascists, the BUF. Where did they come from? What did they look like? What was their ideology?
So the BUF, they were founded and really dominated by Sir Oswald Mosley, who was from a British aristocratic family. He'd previously been a mainstream politician, but had always been quite restless. He'd started off in the Conservative Party after the First World War. He'd been a military officer during the First World War. He then, in the mid-20s, crossed Parliament to join the Labour Party and briefly became a member of the cabinet in the Labour government. But he'd never been entirely satisfied with the mainstream political environment, and partly that was out of kind of impatience with pace at which things happened, the slow pace in his regard at which things happened, but also in terms of his beliefs, which started to become increasingly radical over the late 20s and early 30s. So that led him to first leave the Labour Party, and he founded a kind of proto-fascist party called the New Party, which contested elections in the early 30s, but didn't do very well, didn't win any seats, certainly. And then in 1932, he made the decision to kind of complete his transition to fascism, and in late 1932, he founded the BUF. And the BUF itself was quite typically fascist in the kind of the trappings, had all the trappings of fascism, the uniforms, the kind of quasi-military structure, the marches, but also not just in its activity, but in Mosley's ideology as well. This idea of this ultra-nationalistic idea of bringing about rebirth of the country being on its knees and requiring a vigorous new force focused around youth and action to try and revive the fortunes of the country. And so initially, as I say in the book, the BUF attempted to pursue a more respectable kind of form of fascism, one that it felt was suited to the British environment, so it downplayed some of the more extreme aspects of fascist belief and activity that had come to prominence in other parts of Europe. So it tried to downplay its violence, it tried to deny that it was anti-Semitic, so it made an attempt to look slightly more respectable and more suited to the British political environment, but this quite rapidly fell apart. It was initially quite successful. The party attracted a large membership, a lot of positive interest over the first couple of years, but as I say in the book, in mid-1934, there was a particularly violent fascist meeting at the Olympia Meeting Hall in London. The fascist stewards violently ejected anti-fascist hecklers. It's attracted a lot of negative publicity. And it was from that moment that the true nature of fascism in Britain started to emerge and kind of pushed Mosley and the party beyond the pale. And so we see over the remainder of the 1930s, the party become more explicit in its anti-Semitism. It continued to present both anti-Semitism and violence as defensive necessities pushed upon it, but it became far more willing to use both and less embarrassed about admitting some of these facets of its ideology and its activity. And then so over the rest of the 1930s, the party never managed to kind of reach the heights that it had in its early days. And what it became particularly well known for, what it's best remembered for in British public memory, is this vicious anti-Semitic East End campaign that happened in East London, especially in the mid-1930s, where the fascists realized that there was at least a minority of local residents who are sympathetic towards their ideas, especially their anti-Semitism, because the area housed a very large Jewish population. And so they began to focus all their efforts in this one relatively poor area of London, which resulted in these great outbreaks of violence, most famously the Battle of Cable Street, this big clash between the fascists and their opponents. And then over the late 1930s, we do see a slight revival in their fortunes due to international circumstances. Oswald Mosley launched this so-called anti-war campaign to try to prevent Britain from going to war with Nazi Germany, and that attracted a degree of interest and some sympathy among certain parts of British society who are keen to avoid Britain getting into another war. There was also a refugee crisis taking place with lots of refugees, especially Jewish refugees, arriving in Britain. And so, again, this was something that the BUF was able to exploit. So there was a minor bump in interest in the party in the late 1930s. But once the war broke out, the British fascists were regarded as potential fifth columnists, as traitors. And so in 1940, the British authorities forcibly disbanded the party and interned many of its leading figures, including Mosley, for a large section of the war. So that kind of covers the main aspects of its history over the 1930s.
Great. So can you tell us what has been the standard narrative about the British Union of Fascists and their anti-Semitism, and how does your research challenge this narrative? What form did their anti-Semitism take? And you particularly talk about Mosley's key role in formulating the party's anti-Semitism. Can you expand on that for us?
Yeah. There's probably two main areas in which I've tried to challenge existing perceptions of when, how, and why the party adopted anti-Semitism. And as I said a moment ago, initially Mosley had tried to make his party appear more respectable, and that meant publicly downplaying anti-Semitism. And a lot of the scholarship, especially scholars who have focused on British fascism in particular, so not necessarily historians of the Jewish community or of anti-fascism, but those who have focused on fascism in particular, although they don't take Mosley's words completely credulously, there has been a pervading sense in the historiography that Mosley, and certainly Mosley himself and many other members of the party, did not want the BUF to be anti-Semitic in its early days. This was not something that they intended. And so the belief has been that it was only in autumn 1934 that the party officially decided to adopt anti-Semitism, which was announced at a series of meetings that Mosley held in London and Manchester during that period. And the general sentiment in most of the historiography is that, to varying degrees, Jews themselves were responsible for inducing this decision by Mosley due to the aggressive way that they'd opposed the BUF. And this was very much the fascists' own narrative of events. They claimed that they'd been innocently propagating their ideas without any anti-Semitism at all, and they'd actually gone out of their way to deny that anti-Semitism was part of their program. And yet Jews had anyway decided to aggressively oppose the party, both at a kind of street level of Jewish communists or other anti-fascists attacking fascist events, but also at a higher level of these alleged Jewish financiers who were supporting anti-fascist opposition financially, who were putting financial pressure on the media, on businesses who were sympathetic towards the fascists. So the fascists created this version of events in which they were forced to become anti-Semitic by the Jews themselves. And a lot of the historiography subsequently has kind of accepted to varying degrees this version of events, although they admit that there were genuine anti-fascists within the BUF and that there were some other reasons for its decision to officially adopt anti-Semitism. Most scholars have included this so-called interactionist element within their explanations of BUF anti-Semitism, alleging that Jews, by their aggressive approach to fascism, helped to push the BUF towards anti-Semitism. And that was one of the things that immediately, as I started to to analyze the fascist discourse, especially in the early days of the party, that was something that immediately struck me as not being entirely correct. And it was quite apparent even from his very first meeting, his very first public address as the leader of the fascist party, that Mosley was already outlining the elements of an anti-Semitic position. And of course, he didn't make this explicit for the first couple of years of the party's existence, because he understood that anti-Semitism was not something that was well established in the British political environment. It existed, but not necessarily in such explicit form. And so he understood that he had to be careful with this aspect of policy. But it's quite clear that long before the autumn of 1934, which is the date that he allegedly adopted anti-Semitism, long before then, over the previous 2 years, there are clear indications in not just Mosley's own speeches, but in the propaganda produced by his party and its newspapers, that it was preparing the ground for an anti-Semitic position. And my argument is that the party, first of all, understood that it couldn't be explicitly anti-Semitic straight away, but it wanted to actually create the conditions in which this anti-Semitism could be activated. And the way that it wanted to do this was by provoking Jews into a violent response, which the fascists could then use to lay out this narrative that their anti-Semitism was a response to that aggression. So we see periodically over the first couple of years of the party's existence, these quite short but intense outbursts of anti-Semitism in Mosley's own speeches and writing and in the propaganda that it produced, that were designed to provoke fears amongst Jews and push them into active forms of resistance to the party. And actually, funny enough, they weren't really successful in that regard, in the sense that before late 1934, there was relatively little direct Jewish anti-fascist activity, but nevertheless, there was enough of it, and it was easy enough for the fascists to highlight cases of Jewish opposition to the BUF for them to try to push this narrative, this version of events, that anti-Semitism was something that had been forced upon them. And related to this, the second argument that I've made, and the second way I've tried to challenge existing perceptions of the fascist anti-Semitism, was to show how directly Mosley himself was in control of this process. There's been, again, a pervading sense in the historiography that Mosley was forced in this direction, not just by Jewish actions, but by more anti-Semitic members of his party, that he himself was relatively uninterested in anti-Semitism. And certainly it's true that before he founded the BUF, he'd shown no interest at all in anti-Semitism in his political career. And so starting in the 1970s, when a very sympathetic biography of Mosley was published by Robert Skidelsky, that established an idea of Mosley as a reluctant anti-Semite, one who was forced to take this position by Jews and by other members of his fascist party. And what I tried to show is that right from the very start, it was clear that the way Mosley spoke about Jews, or sometimes more generally and indirectly about aliens, but with a clear implication that he was talking about Jews, it was apparent immediately that this was an integral part of the program, and especially the ideology, the fascist ideology that he wished to promote as leader of the BUF. And so we see this increasingly. This was sketched out in 1932, 1933, but immediately from 1934, when the party officially adopted anti-Semitism, Mosley was always at the forefront of this process and making absolutely clear the relationship between his fascist beliefs and the anti-Semitism that was an integral part of them.
That's great. So we've already touched on this a little bit, but can you tell us about the different debates in the Jewish community about how best to combat fascism? What were the different groups involved, and how did these debates evolve throughout the early and the mid-30s?
Yeah, so the traditional view, which has some credence, is that there was this kind of dichotomy within Anglo-Jewry, that on one hand you had the Jewish leadership, who were this more respectable elements of society, who were usually came from long-standing Anglo-Jewish families who were fully assimilated members of the middle classes. That they were the belief, the traditional belief, is that they were rather complacent about the fascist threat. That they felt that if it was just ignored, it would go away, or it wasn't particularly serious. Whereas, by contrast, the Jewish working classes, in particular, who were often more recent immigrants who had come from Eastern Europe, or their parents or grandparents had come from Eastern Europe over the last half century or so, that they presented a much more vigorous response to the fascists. And this was because they couldn't afford to be complacent, because they were in the front line of fascist activity, and in particular the East End, which I mentioned earlier, which became the focus of the fascist campaigning, housed the largest Jewish population in Britain. And this was a poor working class, recently immigrated Jewish community. And so in direct response to the threat of fascism that was increasing, this vicious campaign of intimidation, sometimes physical violence against Jews, they were forced to respond. So that's been the traditional image of these two different responses: the elites, who remained quite passive and complacent, and the Jewish working class, who were quite active and vigorous in responding to the fascists. And up until maybe 1936, this has some validity, although, as I mentioned earlier, in the very earliest days of the fascist party, there was relatively little organized Jewish resistance. But certainly once the fascists became openly anti-Semitic in late 1934, we do see this divergence between a more kind of quietist policy by the Jewish leadership and a more active one by the Jewish working class. But what I argue in the book is that this situation only really holds until about late 1936, and over the last 3 years or so of the fascist party's existence, we see a growing convergence between the different sections of the Jewish community. And this is something that previously, before my book, hasn't really been acknowledged anywhere in the scholarship. And what we find is there's this dual process going on at both the top and the bottom of the community. The elite Jewish leadership started to realize that perhaps it had misjudged the fascist threat, but in particular that its passivity had created a great deal of anger within the rest of the Jewish community, which was causing the Jewish leadership problems in its attempts to exert its authority over the community. So it started to introduce a more active, direct anti-fascist policy. It never supported direct confrontation with the fascists, but it did start to support various forms of anti-fascist activity. And then at the same time, at the bottom end of the community, among the working class, we again see a shifting approach. That previously they'd favoured, many Jews had favoured quite an assertive response, which had often involved directly challenging the fascists on the streets, disrupting their meetings, heckling, trying to prevent the fascists from holding their events. But what many Jewish anti-fascist organizations began to realize, and non-Jewish anti-fascist organizations as well began to realize, was that this type of activity was often counterproductive, because the fascists thrived off conflict. The more their meetings were disrupted, and especially the more they were disrupted by Jews, the more it allowed the fascists to portray themselves as victims of some kind of Jewish conspiracy, to silence them, to silence the true voice of the British people. And many anti-fascists started to realize that the kind of aggressive approach that some of them had taken was actually working against their interests. And so we see this process in particular take place after the Battle of Cable Street, which I mentioned a moment ago. This was the most famous anti-fascist event in British history, when a huge crowd of around 100,000 anti-fascists congregated in East London to block a fascist procession that was due to take place through that part of the city. The event was extremely violent. There were almost 100 arrests, tens of injuries. What happened afterwards, although on the day itself the fascists were prevented from marching, the BUF mostly were able to exploit this to support this narrative of victimhood. And this actually led to an increase in sympathy for and membership of the fascists in East London. It led to a rise and intensification in the fascists' anti-Jewish campaign. There was an increase in anti-Semitic propaganda, in physical attacks against Jews. And this led many anti-fascists to start to reconsider their approach and to try to moderate the types of behavior that that they'd been involved with. And so what we see over the late 1930s, and this really I'm the first to explore this process, we see that the different sections of the Jewish community in Britain start to converge around a shared approach to anti-fascism that they coordinated with one another, that involved various forms of anti-fascist propaganda designed to attack the fascists themselves, but also to advertise the contribution of the Jewish community and to refute some of the anti-Semitic slanders that the fascists were promulgating. It also involved secretive attempts to investigate the fascists. So the Jewish leadership placed moles and spies within fascist organizations, collected a huge amount of intelligence on what the fascists were doing. It also involved lobbying of the authorities to try to encourage them to prohibit fascist marches, to introduce legal measures to restrict fascist activity and especially fascist anti-Semitic activity. And so we see over the late 1930s this process of convergence taking place.
Great. So what was the effect of the Jewish struggle against fascism on the overall character and identity of Anglo-Jewry, of sort of the politics and of belonging, I suppose, in an ongoing sense?
Yeah, it's become an integral part of the formation of an Anglo-Jewish identity. And this is something that's especially the case for, as I mentioned, the more recently immigrated Jewish community who arrived from Eastern Europe in the late 19th century and early 20th century. And by the 1930s, these Jews were still struggling to find their place in British society and their identity, to balance their Jewish and their British identities alongside one another. These were mostly second and third generation immigrant Jews who born in Britain but still not entirely accepted by many sections of British society. And the struggle against fascism helped to provide them with a sense of mission, a sense of participation in this struggle. And this was, of course, not just a Jewish struggle. There was a huge anti-fascist movement which operated at various levels. You had the Communist Party doing much of the street-level organization of anti-fascist activism. Then at higher levels, you had political parties like the Labour Party who were involved in the more political aspects of opposing fascism. You then had the state authorities who worked alongside the Jewish leadership to try to restrict fascist activity. And so at each level, Jews were collaborating with non-Jewish partners to try to, in with this shared interest of trying to limit or restrict fascist activity. And so for many Jews, this became a kind of a defining feature of who they were. And this is something that's especially become ingrained in the post-war period. Of course, after the Second World War, anti-fascism became not just the domain of the far left or of the Jewish community, but of course, Britain had just fought a war against fascism, against the European counterparts of the British fascist movement. And so the fight against fascism became a kind of a patriotic duty, became a sense of part of British identity. And so for Jews, this provided them a kind of a route into Britishness in a way, one that allowed them to both assert their identity as Jews, standing up to fascist anti-Semitism, but also to show themselves as part of this broader British struggle against fascism, against extremism, against politicized forms of prejudice. And so even today, in fact, especially today, this idea of the Jewish struggle against fascism in the 1930s and also in the post-war period when Mosley tried to revive his movement, and especially key events like the Battle of Cable Street in October 1936 have become an integral part of Anglo-Jewish identity.
That's great. Well, thanks very much for your time today, Daniel. It's a fascinating book. Congratulations on it. Just before you leave, can you tell us what you're working on next?
Yeah, so the project, I've only recently started to undertake it, so it's in the very early stages, but it's actually an offshoot of the book we've just been discussing. One of the key figures in the book is the president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, which is Anglo-Jewry's official representative body. The president was Neville Lasky, and Lasky comes from a family that became quite prominent during this period. His brother Harold was a prominent socialist Labour Party intellectual. Their father Nathan was one of the leaders of the Jewish community in Manchester, the second largest Jewish community in Britain. And Harold, the socialist intellectual, has received a lot of attention in from historians, but Neville and Nathan have received very little. And so the next project I'm going to be working on is a look at the Lasky family and the role that they played in many of the momentous events that were taking place during this period. So the struggle against fascism, Zionism, and the establishment of the Jewish state of Israel, the whole process of not just Jewish, but immigration, migration generally, assimilation, the question of identity and balancing Jewish and British identities.
That sounds really interesting. We'll have to have you back on New Books in Jewish Studies to talk about that. So thanks very much for listening. With us, we've had Daniel Tillis talking about his new book, British Fascist Antisemitism and Jewish Responses, 1932 to 1940. Published in 2015 by Bloomsbury. Thanks very much, Daniel.